ngingi
In 1857, a German linguist, Wilhelm Heinrich Emanuel Bleek, born in Berlin, found himself on Robben Island, off the coast of South Africa, near Cape Town, the place where Nelson Mandela would be imprisoned 107 years later, for 18 years of his life. But when Bleek was there, others were imprisoned on the island. 1857 was the height of the cattle-killing movement among the Xhosa people, currently the second largest racial group in South Africa. But in 1857, what happened was a 16-year-old Xhosa girl named
Nonkaes
had a religious experience, saying that she received a message from the Xhosa ancestors that if the Xhosa killed all their cattle, one of the main things they relied on for subsistence, the Europeans would be driven out of the land. She wasn't believed at first, but slowly the movement grew and people began killing their cattle, which, as you may expect, did not end well. And you know, this might seem super weird and kind of an insane thing to do, but the context is that this occurred between the 8th and 9th Xhosa Wars, mainly between the British Empire and the Xhosa people, as well as some Dutch. So if you see all these wars as a single thing, it's the longest lasting military action of European colonialism, happening for a full century between 1779 and 1879. So, you know, a whole century of wars is one of those things that might make you act in some pretty weird ways. However, the Xhosa today are different from the Xhosa who first came to the Cape in South Africa, likely many centuries before us, and before Bleek as well, in 1857. The chaos of things like century-long wars of aggression from people who come from super far away led to distinct ethnic groups fading away as they merged into the Xhosa ethnic group. One of these were the San people. The San are also known as Bushmen. San is a general term for a lot of related ethnicities that are found in southern Africa and are indigenous hunter-gatherers. Bleek met some San prisoners on Robben Island in 1857, and they made quite the impression. This was the first time Bleek had met any San, and he conducted interviews with some of the San prisoners. Then he decided to dedicate his remaining life to this exact thing. Over the next decade and a half, Bleek and his colleague slash sister-in-law, Lucy Lloyd, recorded 12,000 pages of information that the South African San people told them, some in the language which is still spoken today, but mostly in the aforementioned language Xhosa, which is extinct, along with the Xhosa as a distinct people. Bleek was originally concerned with their language, but these 12,000 pages encompass a lot more, from stories of their individual lives to descriptions of various aspects of San culture and society. He recorded information from the San until his death in 1874, 1 year before San's de Sataola was to enter Altamira for the first time, one of the two beginnings of the modern academic notion of prehistoric cave wall art. Lucy Lloyd continued interviewing and organizing the information. Some of it was published for the first time in 1903, the same year that Emil Kartelak wrote his Mea Culpa, and cave art was accepted in the mainstream of academia, the other beginning of the modern academic notion of prehistoric cave wall art. Last episode, we went over a conventional history of modern studies of prehistoric cave wall art, and I ended with the structuralists and their falling out of favor. I mentioned that for the next few decades, no predominant theory filled the void. There was just a trend toward the particular, just analyzing and recording individual sites rather than trying to tie them all together with some grand overarching theory. I said that this episode, we would be looking at what could be called the predominant theory in the 21st century, although it's not as pervasive as structuralism. There's many, you know, disagreements, other lenses, ways of looking at it. And this theory came from this archive of 12,000 pages about the San from the 19th century. The archive became useful because the San have a tradition of rock art. The idea is that by looking at their cultural use of rock art, We can maybe ascertain what the Paleolithic people were up to at the famous places like Le Sceau and Chauvet, at least somewhat. Some have called this corpus of their traditions a Rosetta Stone for Paleolithic cave art. The researcher that is most well known for this is South African archaeologist James David Lewis Williams, born in 1934. In 1968, he read Bleak and Lloyd's book Specimens of Bushman Folklore, published in 1911, kind of an overview of their 12,000-page archive. This is because Lewis Williams was doing a PhD on the rock art of Drakensberg, painted by a San people who no longer exist as a distinct group. In other words, it wasn't possible to find a grandchild of any of the artists. He recorded about 4,000 different images in his thesis, which became influential in rock art studies throughout the world. However, he soon changed his methods, not yet satisfied. He was more and more doubting what he had been taught about San rock art by his anthropology professors. One of the main things he was doubting was the idea that was predominant in academia at the time, that San rock art was sort of merely a record of everyday life, with maybe a few images here and there relating to myth and cosmology and deep stuff like that, but most of it was quotidian, everyday, not too remarkable, beyond some of them being pleasing to the eye. He looked at these ethnographies of the San alongside this archive, a practice of the of Botswana and Namibia, which is still practiced into the 20th century, called the trance dance, was an important part of Lewis Williams' theory. The Ju Twansi are another San group, I should mention. Many San cultures, I think all of them traditionally, practice what can be called shamanism, and Lewis Williams found that shamanism and trance and hallucinations played a bigger role in San rock art than researchers had thought. I should mention that he implies that he wasn't alone in this. There were some other researchers who were also turning toward this archive to see if they could use it to explain the rock art. He doesn't mention them by name, though. His book has a few things running underneath the cave art focus. One is the importance of metaphor for human thought. This was one reason that nobody European had figured out yet that the rock art was related to shamanism. They didn't respect metaphor enough. Lewis Williams says, quote, "Then there was a breakthrough. I realized that the ethnography, the San myths, and their own explanations of specific images did not explain the art in any direct sense. Even San people's comments on specific rock paintings did not provide the simple answers for which researchers were hoping. On the contrary, both the ethnography and the art require explanation because both are permeated and structured by a set of metaphors and by San notions of the cosmos. Much of the painted and engraved imagery, even that which appears most realistic, is shot through with these metaphors and shows signs of having been processed by the human mind as it shifted back and forth along the spectrum of consciousness. The same metaphors necessarily structured the explanations of images that San people provided. The San explained the images in their own terms, not in the language of anthropologists. Metaphor, mind, image, society, and cosmos coalesce." Unquote. The San shamans try to activate their supernatural powers to enter the spirit worlds, and they traditionally enter states of altered consciousnesses through rhythmic movement, concentration, and hyperventilation. So they trip out without using drugs, in other words. Quote, "The San do not use hallucinogens. Instead, they induce an altered state of consciousness by intense concentration, audio driving, prolonged rhythmic movement, and hyperventilation, swift, shallow breathing. During the dance, female shamans sometimes rise from their circle around the fire and join the men with more graceful steps and gestures. Dances begin lightheartedly, but gather intensity until the night is filled with the sounds of songs and the cries of the shamans. When large numbers of people are present, and especially if a sizable animal has been killed, the San may dance a few times a week. At other times of the year, when the bands are smaller, they dance less frequently. In deep trance, the shamans' spirits are believed to leave their bodies through the top of their head. They may then travel to other parts of the country to find out how friends and relatives are faring, or they may go to God's house, where they plead for the lives of the sick." Unquote. And here's where we get back to rock art. They would enter these other realms, these spirit worlds, at rock art sites, using the rock art. Their main religious ritual is that dance that all the people take part in, the trance dance, and one of the goals of the trance dance is to heal. During these altered states of consciousness, they often experience turning into another animal. Another common experience is a feeling of their power, kind of like their potential power, exploding from their body, exiting themselves, flying upwards, outwards, and they travel into another realm, just like the shamans. They refer to this journey as dying, metaphorically, and the trance dance contains many references and metaphors for death. The journey to another realm is like dying because both this death and real death involve the soul leaving the body. I mentioned that Lewis Williams's theory is debated. It's probably the current predominant general theory, but only because the trend was to not create general theories. Many people have issues with it, coming from different angles. A few sources of contention are Lewis Williams's interpretation of the ethnographic record of trance dances, also the records themselves, written in an earlier time period when anthropology was less precise, less aware of its own biases, etc., and also whether it's good practice to use ethnographies of a nearby culture to theorize about a different, related culture, a culture that no longer exists. But Lewis Williams thinks that the Ju Tuanxi of the North use concepts similar enough to the Ham in the South, this idea that there's a sort of general San belief among the different groups of San, to analyze the rock art images with. Lewis Williams's analysis found that the rock art had symbolism related to the trance dance. He suggests that some of the rock art may be painted by the shamans as a way of sort of recreating their visions, a way of bringing what they saw on their journeys to these other realms back into this one. For example, one of the paintings is of a human with an antelope head, wearing a cloak made out of skin with blood coming out of their nose. The blood coming out of their nose and the half-human, half-animal figure suggest to Lewis Williams that this was a person on a journey into other realms in a hallucinatory trance state, since bleeding out of the nose is common, as well as this feeling of turning into another animal. A big reason that Lewis Williams was diverting from the previously predominant beliefs about San rock art was because the famous early 20th century prehistorian and cave art specialist Abbé Bruel visited Drakensberg and saw the rock art, and his interpretations became the most widespread ones in academia, not the explanations hidden away in Bleak and Lloyd's archive. People who are definitely more knowledgeable about the anthropological context of the San. And just to show how wrong he was, Abbé Bruel thought that a human-like figure painted carrying a flower in one hand and a bow in the other with an exposed penis was a European girl. I don't know the specifics of his reasoning there, but I do know that he was very colonial, very, very much obsessed with Europe being the center of art. So he loved the caves and the cave art in France and Spain, but not so much the San rock art. And you know, obviously, if the San rock art involved like the cosmos and metaphor and everything, then Europe couldn't be the center of rock art anymore. But Lewis Williams, luckily, found accounts of the San treating the rock art as more than just a representation of daily life. For example, there is one where a young girl describes accompanying some San hunters hunting an eland, so this like sort of antelope-like animal, which is very important in many San cosmologies. Lewis Williams tells us about the event. He says, quote, "In the early 1980s, an old woman of San descent, who was living just south of the Drakensberg, and whose father had been a shaman artist, explained that on certain occasions, a young girl accompanied the San hunters. By simply pointing at an eland, the girl could hypnotize it and lead it back to the camp. The old woman explained that eland blood contained potency, and that it was therefore mixed with the paint. Her words and actions suggested that a painting made with eland blood was a kind of reservoir of potency. As we watched, she danced in the rock shelter and turned to the paintings that her father had made so long ago. She lifted her hands and said, that power would flow into her. Clearly for the San, rock paintings were far more than mere pictures. Okay. But applying Bleek and Lloyd's archive to San rock art studies wasn't the only innovation of Lewis Williams's. Remember, this eventually led to him developing a new theory for the rock art of France and Spain. It's kind of cool. We talked about in episode 3.2 that Western academia thought that art originated in Western Europe in the early 20th century, but as the years progressed and their scope widened, their biases softened, and more data and evidence came in, it became really clear that this wasn't the case. Art is a dispersed phenomenon. Just, you know, the eyes of modern science were looking at Spain and France more closely because that's where most of modern science was at that time. So data from all around the world eventually knocked down this Eurocentric notion. But the cool part is that now we have a case of art from a colonized people giving academia a new theory of European cave art. So it's like the next level. Right, I should note, Bleek said that most of the San he talked to were very happy to share their knowledge, according to Bleek, of course. But he says because they sensed that their culture may not survive much longer, they were very happy to, you know, tell people about it. Since, you know, their lands and population had already suffered immensely from decades of colonization. The other innovation of Lewis Williams's was that he first noticed that the San rock art incorporated a lot of geometric designs, less talked about than the representational art, like always, the mimetic curse. And Lewis Williams was around in the 1970s, so much later than all of these earlier cave art researchers we talked about. And by this time, there was quite the corpus of neurophysiological literature on hallucinations. So Lewis Williams was like, I wonder if these geometric designs that seem to be very common, like just as common as these representational images, I wonder if there's any relationship between those geometries and the geometries that people see when they hallucinate in the laboratory. So he studied this neurophysiological literature on hallucinations, and yeah, he found some interesting things, some commonalities. These observations rely on a key axiom that the brains of modern humans are essentially the same. When modern humans began, of course, is debated, but all the accepted answers certainly include the artists of the Upper Paleolithic in Spain and France, the artists of Altamira and Lasso and Chavez. So the axiom is that the brains of the San painters were essentially the same as the Upper Paleolithic artists. Of course, everybody's individual brain is different to every other individual brain, but essentially the same means, you know, the similarities kind of overpower the differences, or the similarities are more primary than the differences. I don't know. I'm sure you can understand what that means. You know, there's a good quote by somebody that I read once that's like, every human is the same as every other human, the same as some other humans, and unlike any other human. You know, it's, I love that quote in terms of thinking about this sort of thing, similarities and differences. Anyways, but essentially the same means that they had the same possibilities, maybe. It's really cool to think about as well. I'm sure this is debated too, but if we go with this, it's cool to think that all the changes in how we think and how we experience are due to culture and technology and the knowledge that we create. Of course, this relies on a second axiom, that of scientific materialism, that consciousness comes from only the matter of the brain. But if we take these two axioms as true, as many scientists do at least, it's cool to think that all these different ways of thinking that exist throughout humanity, throughout cultures and histories, like transcendent religious experiences and shamanism, all these are possible with our brains too. We've just developed a world where that makes less sense. In fact, that's one aspect of Lewis Williams's theory. He doesn't like how researchers who focus on the development of the human mind or prehistory or cave art or anything else like this have this view of the mind very much tied to modernity and Western science and stuff that really focuses on the rational mind and places every other form of consciousness on the periphery. Lewis Williams prefers to talk about consciousness as a spectrum, of which the rational mind is only a part. In series one, we talked about the anthropologist Jack Goody and his thoughts about whether certain basic logic, formalized for the first known time by the ancient Greeks, stuff like the modus tollens, whether that's understood by all cultures or whether writing is necessary to develop things like that. He asked this question when thinking about the people he spent many years living with, the Lodaga in Western Africa. Do the Lodaga know that if all men are mortal and Socrates is a man, that therefore Socrates is mortal? But Lewis Williams is going, hey, wait a second. A just as legitimate question is whether people in the West or modernity know that, metaphysics aside, you can experience traveling into other worlds if you do certain actions correctly. It's not that Jack Goody is like bad for asking that question. It's more that if researchers are only asking that question about rationality, it's perhaps biased in favor of the culture that spawned academic anthropology. Kind of saying something like, okay, who cares about shamanisms and trances and hallucinations? Yeah, sure, that stuff's super important for other cultures, central even, but it's not like objectively important. But the modus tollens and stuff like that, something not important in many cultures, but pretty important in mine, yeah, that's really important. We should focus on that. Plato and all of his footnotes showed us the way out of the cave towards objectivity, but other cultures maybe haven't gotten there yet. You know, that's the sort of thinking that Lewis Williams is pointing out. I hope that makes sense. I think Lewis Williams sees this overemphasis of rationality as one of the reasons nobody was looking into whether trance and hallucinations were involved in the creation of prehistoric cave art. But the really cool part of this view of consciousness as a spectrum is how it relates to other cultures. As we said, cultures within modernity generally highlight the rational aspect of human consciousness and downplays the others. But if consciousness is a spectrum, that means that all human cultures have had to build up conceptualizations and understandings of this spectrum in their particular way. When you just focus on the rational aspect of human consciousness, it leads you to much more boring and maybe often dangerous conclusions and perspectives, where, you know, obviously the culture that invented airplanes and modern science and all the rest, that's the most rational culture, the culture that's best at rationality. So history becomes this like linearly progressive thing with certain people continuing this trajectory, and a whole bunch of other people, for some reason, in the 21st century, still not being rational to the level we've figured out to be, and therefore impediments to progress, right? But if we frame consciousness as a spectrum, we can think about history and prehistory in much more interesting ways. The spectrum of consciousness becomes like the spectrum of colors. I've talked in episode 4.1 about the cultural variations in dividing up the color spectrum, like some cultures only divided into two categories, warm or light colors and cold or dark colors. Others have three or four, and then you get to the other end of the spectrum, and you walk into a paint store in an industrialized country and you see like a ridiculously fine-grained categorization of the color spectrum. It's funny, the classic Western color scheme, Roy G. Biv, that was invented by Newton, and he originally came up with six colors, but he wanted seven because that was a number that he liked better and was important for some sort of cultural reasons, like it was a classic lucky number at that time or something. So that's why we say that rainbows are made up of violet and indigo, rather than just saying like purple or whatever. I remember being a kid and being like, this is such bullshit. I've never heard anyone call anything violet or indigo. Why are these called the main colors? So if you were the same, now you know. Anyways, this means that similarly, consciousness is a spectrum that's divided up and categorized differently in different cultures. I've been trying to think of possibilities, like potential ways of categorizing consciousness that seem interesting. So let me know if you think of any. The point is that this provides a different frame through which to view other cultures, whether in different places or times. It took a super long time to develop a worldview in which it makes sense to distrust your senses to the degree that we do. E. Evans Pritchard, the famous anthropologist, said that faith and skepticism are alike traditional when studying the Azande and talking about their witch doctors, since people would call certain witch doctors bullshit, saying that they were frauds, but they never developed a general skepticism towards witch doctorism or whatever it's called. They would remain just being skeptical about individual ones, preferring other ones who they thought were genuine. So skepticism is a thing that all humans have, but there's evidence that's convincing to me at least that writing is a necessary precursor to the development of generalized skepticism. That type, as well as certain developments in understanding. Like, so you distrust your senses by saying that the earth revolves around the sun, rather than saying the sun rises and sets, like that's the objective truth. In other words, it took a whole bunch of stuff to create this framework where we have rationality so obviously on the top, a framework where the world is comprised of inert stuff called matter, and consciousness arises from this matter stuff being arranged in a particular way. There's no other realms and stuff. This is a very unusual way of looking at the world if you look at all humans that have ever existed. For most people in history, I think, if they hallucinated, some vortex sucked them into a darkness that became an insane psychedelic world, they would look at you like you were insane if you said, "Oh, yeah, that's just your brain being weird, actually. Yeah, ignore all that stuff." Or, I mean, look at if it look at it if it's pretty, but I don't think it's meaningful or anything. Dreams too. Like if you're just like, "Oh, you know how you travel to other worlds and other times and, memories and stuff like that whenever you sleep." Yeah, that stuff is It doesn't matter. It's just your brain being kind of weird, kind of quirky. You can ignore that. Most people would be like, "What are you talking about?" Like, when I fall asleep, I literally travel to other worlds so often, and I can feel my body in those other worlds. And that's all just not meaningful? What? A lot of people among all humans who have ever existed probably wouldn't talk about it in this way, right? They'd say that. They wouldn't say, "Oh, I was dreaming," right? They'd have different words for it. They'd be like, "I traveled to this other world," or something like that. They'd say that they saw a vortex, not that they hallucinated it. And in fact, in a lot of cultures, this ability of the brain to hallucinate, that isn't just something that's worrying. That's a thing that's pretty cool and obviously meaningful. If you didn't have this bedrock of centuries that developed this thing called scientific materialism, this framing of consciousness as a spectrum, as long as we combine it with some basic historical, psychological, and anthropological facts, allow us to look at history in a different way than this colonial idea of linear progressive cultural evolution from primitive to civilized, from irrational to rational. And instead, see non-modern cultures as not irrational, but conceptualizing the human spectrum of consciousness in different ways, ways that make much more sense than this extreme heightening of the rational, this distrust in the senses and visions and dreams. And this way of seeing the world that only really makes sense after a very long and complicated and particular historical process that leads to certain human characteristics, like generalized skepticism and building knowledge from observations in a more formalized and standardized way, connected to larger pools of data and certain technologies and a whole bunch of other stuff. As David Abrams says, for people in a lot of cultures, if you see a crow out of the corner of your eye and then you turn and it's a person, that experience isn't your senses deceiving you, as we'd say. That's your senses showing you that this crow just turned into a person. What the fuck's going on? Thank God your eyes caught that in time. David Lewis Williams also proposes that this is the difference between humans and Neanderthals. We have the full spectrum of consciousness. They don't. Quote, because there is no option but to come to terms with the full spectrum of consciousness, people of the Upper Paleolithic must not have only experienced the full spectrum, they must also have divided it up in their own way, and so created their own version of human consciousness. Unquote. Like, I really love this idea of all cultures creating their own version of human consciousness before globalization, you know, an interconnected globe started forcing one version of human consciousness on the world. Anyways, back to brains. If these two axioms are correct, a materialist base of the universe, and that the minds of all modern humans are fundamentally the same, they all have the same potential, then that means that studies done in the Western labs in the 20th and 21st century investigating hallucinations can also be used to investigate both San and Upper Paleolithic rock art. So what do these studies say? The first task of Lewis Williams was to analyze San rock art in terms of these laboratory studies of hallucinations to see if they matched up, to see if the ethnographic information of the nearby San, the Jutuansi, and their trance dances was indeed applicable to the Cham rock art in Drakensberg. The thinking is that if trance and hallucination and shamanism were all important for the creation of the San rock art, and all modern humans have the same brain and nervous system, then maybe we can see some evidence of what we've learned about hallucination in the lab, in the rock art. According to Lewis Williams' reading of the hallucination studies, researchers have found three stages of hallucination: geometric forms, stage one, iconic forms mediated by personal experience and culture, stage two, then analogy giving way to literal vision, like the so-called machine elves of DMT trips. That's stage three. Let's talk about the first, most basic stage first. The geometric patterns people see include, quote, dots, grids, zigzags, nested catenary curves, and meandering lines, unquote. These patterns are hallucinated without connection to any light source. They can be hallucinated with eyes open or eyes closed. I'm sure there are hallucinations experienced that involve light sources too, but Lewis Williams is narrowing down the type of hallucinations that he's concerned with. He also narrows it down by saying he's concerned with hallucinations that are independent of the structure of the optic system. Like you can hallucinate by closing your eyes and pressing on your eyeball in a certain way, and then you see like a circular form in the corner of your eye. But this hallucination is very much based on the structure of your eye and how you're pressing down. And the circle is, of course, based on the circle of your eye, in other words. But there are hallucinations, like hallucinations of animals or certain geometries, that aren't based on the structure of the optic system. He's trying to find things that are cross-cultural, but also not connected to the structure of the eye or anything. The goal is to find things that are wired into the modern human brain. The technical word for the hallucinations that he's concerned with are called entoptic phenomena. And it appears that this stage one of hallucinations, these geometric shapes people see, it's something universal. It can be seen by, or it is seen by, humans who hallucinate in any culture. But then in stage two, it becomes culturally specific. This is the stage where the geometries evolve into something more intense. And these more intense hallucinations are understood by people in terms of their culture, as well as, presumably, like, you know, their individual personality and memories and everything. Like, their brain's trying to make sense of these things in terms of their experience. If you live in a culture where you hunt bison all day, these visions might appear to you as a bison. If you live in a culture where you sit online all day, it might appear to you as a particularly trippy Twitter argument. Whoa, dude, the insults are like fractals, man. Do you see that? Lewis Williams frames this as the brain starting up the engines on one of its main functions, problem solving. The geometries are just sort of weird, but stage two hallucinations are more intense, but less weird, I guess. Kind of interesting. Both intense, but also normal enough for your brain to start being like, okay, what's up? What is that exactly? It starts looking at the perception in terms of previous experience in order to try to match it to something, to make sense of it. And it's not just completely culturally determined. Other things are involved, like an individual might see a round thing as a fruit or a boob, depending on whether they're hungry or horny. Then in stage three, there's another major shift in the form of hallucination. Stage three is characterized by less and less information from the perceptible world reaching the brain. The brain gets more and more overpowered by hallucination, and the hallucinations are less described based on experience and culture, and more like they are witnessing something in the real world. Like they describe things less and less with language like, it looks like X, and more with language like, I see an X, it's right there. The metaphorical and the literal begin to blur, in other words. Many people experience a whirlpool or a rotating tunnel that envelops them, sucks them in, and draws them into its dark center. A really crazy part is that often, quote, the sides of the vortex are marked by a lattice of squares, like television screens. The images on these screens are the first spontaneously produced iconic hallucinations. They eventually overlie the vortex as entoptic phenomena give way to iconic hallucinations, unquote. So, in other words, there's this vortex that people hallucinate, but on the sides, there's like all these television screens that have hallucinations on them, which is pretty wild to imagine. Tunnels and vortexes are a very big part of stage three hallucinations, and they'll come back up, so remember that part. And there's other variations besides this weird television screen thing. Sometimes instead of a dark tunnel like you're probably imagining, there's a bright light at the center of one's vision, and then that creates a tunnel somehow. And then everything else in their vision acts in relation to this tunnel, sometimes moving towards it, like everything is getting sucked down some sort of cosmic drain, and sometimes moving away from it, as I might do in that situation. Sometimes things even confusedly move in both directions at once, somehow, like both towards it and away from it. If you've done like hallucinogenic drugs, you can probably imagine what that might look like. Anyways, here's comedian Matt McCusker describing a tunnel hallucination that occurred during sleep paralysis.
When I disrupt my sleep during the witching hour and go back to bed around like 4:30, it's sleep paralysis time. Almost every time.
Oh man.
Dude, but I like it. I'm a sicko, dude.
Yeah, but what type of sleep paralysis are we talking? Visions?
No, here's what happens to me. So I don't pull myself out of it. I know it's coming because when I'm laying
Yeah.
there, it goes. Vroom. I get these like, vroom, and like I can't explain it, but it doesn't. It's not like a brain shock or a brain zap, but it's like a. It's just like sensation that like goes. It'll happen, and then like a minute later, it'll happen again. It starts going faster and faster, and eventually, I enter the sleep paralysis tunnel where it's like, and
Yeah.
I'm fucked up. I used to get scared, and I'd pop myself up out of that.
Yeah.
Lately, I've been going into it.
Yes.
Let me tell you, that was a spooky, spooky experience,
What
dude.
happened?
So whenever I go into
There's
sleep,
spooky skeletons
dude. So
sending shivers down your spine.
yes, dude, this is what happens. So whenever I like, when you first go into the sleep paralysis, it's nothing but like the spookiest shit possible. I went into it and it was just like, and you see like the scary shit. And I was like, I can't breathe, and I'm just laying there, just like, and all of a sudden I'm like, oh, thank God I woke up. I'm still dreaming.
What type of stuff did you see?
Just like scary. I always see like scary
But
figures.
now this is in your room, correct? Or
This
is
is eyes
in a
closed.
dream?
I'm completely. It's like my eyes are closed. I can't open my eyes. I can't move.
Yes.
I can if I fully fight it. I can get out of it.
Yes.
But I've been like just trying to sink into it and see where it
Okay.
goes. Dude, it's spooky, dude. It's just like scary face. Like you know those masks people put on. It's like a big scary. It's
Yeah.
like shit like that. Scary faces and like it's like weird figures. This is all with my eyes closed.
Yeah.
And I have opened my eyes before and seen it in my room for a second. More so
Yeah.
like the shadow figures.
Shadow figures are the
Scary guys.
spookiest.
I see them in three. I always have a three.
That's a very common thing.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Did you know that was common?
No, I didn't know.
Yeah. See, the one guy in the documentary sees three.
Really?
Usually one guy's wearing like a top hat.
Yes, dude. And it's fucking big square shoulders.
How scary
top
is that?
Hat, dude. So, dude, so I'm
isn't
sitting
that spooky
there.
That I knew that the guy in your dream wore a fucking hat?
Yeah, it is fucking
isn't that fucking scary?
That was the first time I woke up and was in my room but hallucinating with sleep paralysis. That was the Hat Man. That was with his two fucking minions, dude.
Yeah, his two minions right on either side of him.
Yeah, man. It's so scary.
What the fuck was that?
Dude, I don't
what
know.
What the fuck?
I don't know. But, dude, so I'm laying there, dude. I go with it. I'm like, all right, cool. I pass, like, the scary spot. And this is when I get inception to where I'm like, oh, that was weird. Thank God I woke up. And, yeah. But then what happens is I'm like, the thing rattles me so much that I lose my bearings. So I wake up and I'm walking around my room and I'm like, man, I can't use my feet that well. And I'm like, the fuck's going on? And now I'm in like a totally different place. I don't realize I'm dreaming. I'm just walking around like a different house and there's like three kids in a bed. And I was like, hey guys. And they were just completely different kids. And they were like, ah, ah. And I was like,
oh shit.
And I start getting like super confused. Like, where the fuck am I? And I'm walking around. It was that. And I'd wake up. Oh, thank God I'm awake. And I'd walk out of my room and back into some weird setting. I did this like five times last night. It was like five successive dreams. And then finally Brittany tapped me with her foot. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. I'm in my room.
Well, you must have been.
Bro, I was fucked.
I'm sorry. As you were, kids. Who are these kids?
Dude, it was not. It's kind of cool, though, because when you finally come back. Dude, it's like wake up, dream. And you get like really disoriented. And when you come back too, I had a glow all morning. I was just like, man, this is great. You're so happy to be back.
Happy to be back in life.
You're happy to be back, dude, in this dimension.
So I know he only mentioned tunnels once, kind of offhandedly, the tunnel of sleep paralysis. But the reason I played that extended clip is because I'd like you to think about that in light of what we've been talking about, the spectrum of consciousness, right? Imagine experiencing dreams like that, which are fairly common, but without this basis of scientific knowledge that's been built up over the centuries, without this idea that was given to you as a child, that there's this thing called matter, and our brains make consciousness, the matter of our brains, you know, obviously you'd be like, okay, something's going on here. I have to figure this out. And of course, if you're trying to figure out some sort of weird cosmic strange mystery, like where it appeared like the universe held you down in your sleep and like showed you some other world, if you're trying to figure that out, you'd probably talk to your friends, family, etc. Right? Weird things like this would become socially known about, socially discussed, and therefore like societies, cultures, they'd try to figure out what was going on with these weird things that only very particular historical circumstances allow us to discount and go, oh, well, that's just the brain being quirky, right? If the universe held you down and didn't allow you to wake and showed you some creepy stuff and you didn't have, you never read one textbook in your life, imagine how important that would seem, right? Anyways. And not just the sleep paralysis stuff that Matt McCusker talked about, but also the sort of waking up but not being awake thing. That's another very common thing, these pseudo-waking dreams. And that would definitely appear like some alternate reality to most people in history. Anyways, I just thought that was a cool way of more showing rather than telling how cultures would have to grapple with the spectrum of consciousness. Anyways, back to tunnels, funnels, etc. Lewis Williams says this about tunnels, quote, Westerners use culture-specific words like funnels, alleys, cones, vessels, pits, and corridors to describe the vortex. In other cultures, it is often experienced as entering a hole in the ground. Shamans typically speak of reaching the spirit world via such a hole. The Inuit of Hudson Bay, for example, describe a, quote, road down through the earth, unquote, that starts in the house where they perform their rituals. They also speak of a shaman passing through the sea. He almost glides as if falling through a tube. The Bella Coola of the American Northwest Coast believe that a hole is situated between the doorway and the fireplace. The Algonquins of Canada travel through layers of earth. A hole leading into the bowels of the earth is the pathway of the spirits. The Kaniba of the Upper Amazon speak of following the roots of a tree down to the ground. Such reports could easily be multiplied. The vortex and the ways in which its imagery is perceived are clearly universal human experiences. Unquote. So, in stage 3 of hallucinations, people are more and more in their own world, from the scientific materialist perspective, or a strange realm from others. Often people feel themselves transforming to animals and other things, and all these three stages can intermingle. Lewis Williams points to rock art, both San and North American, where figures have zigzag legs and stuff, zigzags being one common form of stage 1 hallucinations. He also looked at San, as well as other shamanic cultures, through the lens of these laboratory studies, and finds commonalities, suggesting that shamanism is so widespread in small-scale, traditional societies worldwide because all people share similar brains, and these hallucinatory states the brain can produce is kind of, you know, what leads to shamanism. Or rather, one basis. I think we can combine this idea with this quote from Peter First, who says, quote, "It is at least possible, though certainly not provable, that the practice of shamanism may have involved from the first, that is, the very beginnings of religion itself, the psychedelic potential of the natural environment," unquote. I really like that idea. Nature as being psychedelic, naturally. Anyways, so Lewis Williams analyzes the San rock art through the lens of these neurophysiological studies. The San believe that the world has three levels, with one above and one below, and the middle one that we live on. So kind of like the Christian heaven and hell and many other societies. That's one of Lewis Williams's points, actually. This is a common framework in many shamanic societies, and he thinks that this commonality is due to all humans sharing the same, essentially the same nervous system. Specifically, due to certain hallucinations that this shared nervous system can create, the ones that involve the tunnel or vortex that we talked about, but also there's ones that involve a sense of weightlessness. So Lewis Williams thinks that there's two sort of general types of hallucination, one being sucked into the ground, one being lifted up above, that lead to the beliefs in this three-tiered cosmos, this upper and lower world, kind of sandwiching our world. But, I mean, I think it might just be because up and down are the two directions that you can't access before modern technology. Like it just kind of makes sense to me, without any laboratory studies, that you'd imagine something up there and something down there, because you can walk all around and you can meet people who are like, oh yeah, I came from over the horizon on that, from that direction. Plus, another point is, like, you know, the cardinal directions are more than just up and down. Up and down, very basic, it's just two things, but, you know, you, if one shamanic society believed in a world to the south and another believed in a world to the east, like another realm, these might not be put together by anthropologists as like a commonality. Does that make sense? Like, do shamanic societies believe in worlds accessed by traveling north, south, east, or west? But those worlds are just more varied. Sometimes east, sometimes north, sometimes west, depending on the vagaries of their histories. Whereas worlds of above and below are just kind of more naturally given to commonality. I don't know. However, we will see that some of the San rock art involves both underwater and in the sky imagery, sometimes together, showing a passage from fish to birds, for example. So Lewis Williams points to more evidence for this interpretation than just what I mentioned here. I don't want to diss it too much. But regardless, there are many more specific aspects of the rock art that show evidence of hallucination based on these laboratory studies. We already mentioned that many of the geometric shapes seen in the lab experiments are found in the rock art, like zigzags. Remember in episode 3.2, We talked about art by destination and art by metamorphosis, and how what we mean by art is only 200 years old. There exists this general, more utilitarian understanding of art, or understandings of art. Well, the Cham San fell into the latter. They lived in shamanistic and animistic worlds, inhabited by spirits and interpenetrated by other realms. And Lewis Williams's analysis shows that the San rock art wasn't just this record of everyday life, like the earlier European researchers thought, but it also wasn't just a representation or a recreation of shamanic experiences. Lewis Williams thinks that their rock art was far more utilitarian than that, often a major part of shamanic practices, of their traveling to other worlds. Not just the images, of course, but the making of the images as well. We can also remember back to the Deleuze episodes about this idea of the mimetic curse, how Western researchers often think that representation is like the goal of art, or like the highest ideal of art, and that often skews their research into other cultures as art. That's exactly what we find here. Lewis Williams is saying that, you know, there are other things besides just the image that are important. The main goal of the San artists was not to represent. Lewis Williams delves into this in great detail, but we can summarize by saying that the making of the images should not be treated as an isolated thing. It was always bound up in everything from social relations to cosmology. I mean, of course, that's the same in our society as well, but we kind of try to push that down, right, as they heighten those relations. Right, I think when we look at art in like museums and stuff in the West, in modernity, whatever, we try to like look at it atomistically, as though it just sort of appeared, as though it was created by a god rather than an artist. We're not really concerned with like where the paint came from, which the San very much are, as we'll see, or, you know, how exactly it was made. Even those little plaques that explain the image, they don't usually go into like how exactly it was made. We're kind of like, that's a secret. That's the artist's secret. You don't want to know how the sausage painting was made. Of course, that's not the only reason to not treat the images like an isolated thing. It's also basic anthropology, right? Even something like what the images are can only really be understood once you understand the whole culture, right? As we saw with the earlier European researchers. Lewis Williams says that this extends to other less obvious things, like how the images were made. We can think back to episode 3.2 and that famous Walter Goldschmidt quote that culture is a whole, not merely in the sense of interconnection, but on a much deeper level. So we were talking about the hypothesis that the images were much more utilitarian than art in modernity, typical of art outside modernity. And not just the images, but the paint too. Quote, "For the San, paint had special powers in that it could dissolve the rock face and allow images of the other world to slip through," unquote. The paint had special powers that could dissolve the rock face and allow images of the other world to slip through. Do you see where we're going with all this? For the San, the rock wall face that they painted upon wasn't just a canvas, it was a veil. It was a wall, often with something behind it, other worlds. And just the paint in their cosmology had the power to break down this wall, not completely, but enough to catch a glimpse, enough to make that membrane somewhat permeable. And that's just the paint. What did the images do? We'll get there. The paint gained its powers partially due to how it was made, red hematite pigment gathered in the mountains on pilgrimages, an action that the nearby Sotho people believed lessened lightning strikes. And then this pigment was heated by a woman on the full moon, and only heated was one able to grind it down into a fine powder. However, this wasn't the end of it. It was then mixed with the blood of a freshly hunted eland, that antelope-like animal that we encountered a while back, very important in the San cosmologies, a species that appears very often in their rock art. According to at least one San woman, this was the only pigment in the area that was mixed with eland blood. So, something important is being implied here. Hunting was important in the production of rock art. a lot more important than you think naively, right? You know, we talked about the hunting magic hypothesis last episode, this idea that the images were made to increase the efficacy of a hunt. But in the sand case, it's kind of a reversal, right? They can't even make the images unless they have a successful hunt. Kind of fun. This also might mean that at least some kinds of painting only took place after a successful hunt. Really cool, but I was asking if just the paint in their cosmology had the power to dissolve walls between worlds, then what did the images do? To ease into it, here's a passage from Lewis Williams where he analyzes one particular sand painting and extrapolates from it. I'll link the image in the show notes. He says, quote, "Figure 30 shows a deep fold or crack in the rock face that has been smeared with black paint. Rising up out of the fold and the paint are seven figures. It is as if the paint is acting as a solvent that makes the crack in the rock face more permeable. The best preserved on the left has a clear eland head. Four smaller figures comprise only necks and heads, the rest of their bodies being apparently behind the rock face. The nasal blood of trance falls from one of the heads. Close to the head of the eland figure is a bunch of at least 10 fly whisks, far more than one would expect to see together in daily sand life. Surrounding the eland figure are 8 fish, 2 eels, and 2 turtles. The painter here has managed to suggest both underground and underwater experiences. The figures rise from inside the rock, that is, from underground, and they are associated with underwater creatures. Indeed, water often seeps through cracks as well as through joint and bedding planes in the walls of rock shelters. These are by no means the only paintings that seem to emerge from behind the rock face. Animals, people, and monsters all do so. Then there are painted lines that represent the threads of light that sand shamans say they climb when they go up to God's house in the sky. Often painted in red and fringed with tiny white dots, these threads appear to weave in and out of the rock face. It seems that the walls of rock shelters were thought of as a veil, suspended between this world and the spirit realm. Shamans pass through this veil, sometimes following the painted threads of light, and, on their return, brought with them revelations of what was happening in the world beyond. We do not have any evidence to suggest that only the shamans painted, but it seems likely that it was the shamans themselves who painted images coming through into the world of the living and visions of the transformations they experienced in the spirit world. Nor do I imply that shamans painted while in trance. The images are too delicate, too fine to have been executed by the trembling hand of a trancer. Rather, sand shamans were manifesting, or recreating, perhaps reliving, their experiences of the supernatural realm while in an alert state. In this way, the painters actualized the tiered cosmos and their journeys through it. I argue that the three levels were not merely conceptual, they were manifest in the rock shelters. The painted images of another world made sense because of their location on the veil, the interface between materiality and spirituality. The rock wall on which paintings were placed was not a tabula rasa, but part of the images. In some ways, it was the support that made sense of the images. Art and cosmos united in a mutual statement about the complex nature of reality. The walls of the shelters thus became gateways that afforded access to realms that ordinary people could not visit. But they could glimpse what it was like in that realm, as painted images filtered through and shamans described their journeys." Unquote. Quite a long passage, but I really love all of that. So, similar to other creative uses of the rock face shape we've talked about, how nature doesn't present us with neutral canvases, and often their unique aspects are utilized, like a hump in the rock for the hump of a bison's back, something like that, or a hole for an eye. The San also make use of the rock art in a particular way that makes sense in terms of the rock wall's idiosyncrasies as well as their shamanism. Often beings that are important in San culture are seen on the rock faces, emerging from cracks and crevices, as though they're entering from another world beyond the veil. There's a particular being in San cosmology that's really cool. I'll go over it as another specific example of their worldview, but also because it's a very cool way of viewing the world. I don't know if this is a common experience, but have you ever been on a grassland or a prairie or, you know, somewhere very open and very flat and seen a rainstorm in the distance? You see dark clouds on the horizon and beneath them falling rain, and how it interacts with the wind makes it uneven from a distance. You see like large curves of rain falling from the storm cloud. If you can't picture it, just Google like rainstorm grassland or something. It looks really cool, and how the San interpret rainstorms in light of how they look on the grassland they live on is even cooler. The San conceive of rain as an animal and call those sweeping curved columns of rain the rain's legs, conceiving of the rainstorm as walking across the land. Quote, "The Cham San spoke of the rain as if it were an animal. The rain bull was the thunderstorm that roared and destroyed the people's huts. The rain cow was the gentle, soaking rain. The columns of rain that fell from beneath a thunderstorm were called the rain's legs, and the rain was said to walk across the land on its legs. Shamans of the rain were believed to catch a rain animal beneath the surface of a waterhole and lead it through the sky to the territories of their own people. There they cut it and killed it so that its blood and milk, if it was female, would fall as rain. The parched ground would thus be renewed, sweet grass would spring up, and herds of antelope would be attracted." Cabo, one of Bleakin Lloyd's teachers, who was himself a rain shaman, expressed the joy of long-awaited rain. "I will cut a she-rain which has milk. I will milk her, then she will rain softly on the ground, so that it is wet deep down in the middle. Then the bushes will sprout and become nicely green, so that the springbok come galloping. They will feel that they can leap about, because the she-rain has fallen everywhere, for she means to make all places wet." Unquote. And there are some rock images showing shamans, highly transformed, very animal-like, capturing or leading these rain animals, and also one showing a rain animal traveling from an area with a bunch of fish to an area with a bunch of birds, presumably showing its journey on the way to cause rain, from the bottom tier of the cosmos to the top, maybe. Both these images of rain animals and the image from a while ago with seven figures emerging from a crack in the wall, these are all, of course, stage 3 visions, if the hypothesis of them being hallucinatorily driven is correct. Lewis Williams also analyzes rock art that's less interesting to talk about, but it shows a lot of stage 1 phenomena, lots of different geometries that are the same ones that people hallucinate in the labs, according to Lewis Williams. He sees a significant, meaningful overlap of the specific shapes in the lab and the rock art. And, you know, there's obviously tons of detailed analysis I'm breezing over here. One interesting thing to note is that some of these geometric shapes have been interpreted as beehives, shapes that have multiple curves nested within each other, and a whole bunch of dots around it, sometimes more than dots, like little dots with wings. So seemingly a good interpretation, right? Especially since sand groups eat lots of honey that they harvest from beehives. However, Lewis Williams is here to complicate this hypothesis. He says that yes, these are likely depictions of beehives and bees, but it's not just a simple representation of their everyday honey gathering. The first reason comes from anthropology, from ethnography. Lewis Williams doesn't say anything about bees in the Bleak archive of the Cham San, but the Ju Tuanci San, quote, "consider bees to be messengers of God, and to have a great deal of potency. They like to dance when the bees are swarming because they believe that they can harness bee potency. They also have a medicine or trance dance song called honey." Unquote. We can combine this fact with the fact that many hallucinating subjects in laboratory studies don't just hallucinate seeing things, they hallucinate hearing things, including very often a buzzing or a humming sound. In the Amazon, the shamans of the Amahuaca people typically interpret these noises as the sounds of various insects and amphibians in the forest, while others conceive of it as rain or wind. So with these two strands of evidence, Lewis Williams suggests, nothing certain of course, but he suggests that sometimes the shamans would have interpreted their hallucinations as involving bees and honey, things very important in their world.
We found a baobab, these giant massive trees, and the boys have cut a hole in it and are now climbing the tree from the inside. This came out of the tree, man. He got stung maybe 50 times and he hauled this out of the inside of a baobab. Whoa!
Oh. In her 2009 book, Caves and the Ancient Greek Mind, Yulia Ustinova extends Lewis Williams' hypothesis, his framework, and applies it to ancient Greece. Very interesting if you're interested in ancient Greece, especially, you know, certain mysteries or enigmas like the Oracle of Delphi and stuff. But Yulia Ustinova also talks about bee hallucinations and how they were around in ancient Greece as well. Anyways, another specific thing Lewis Williams focuses on for a bit is something called the navicular entoptic phenomenon, where someone hallucinates a boat-like shape. There's a few different forms of it, but, quote, in its more elaborate form, this percept comprises two elements, an outer arc characterized by iridescent flickering bars of light or zigzags, and within the arc, a lunate area of invisibility, a black hole that obliterates veridical imagery. Beyond the area of invisibility is the center of vision, unquote. So, to translate that out of a little bit of technical language, your center of vision is hidden from you, and around this black hole at the center of your vision is a shimmering area with geometries and iridescence. Navicular entoptic phenomena are often experienced during migraines, too. So that's one area from modern life that you may have seen these. There are lots of examples of shapes that look like navicular entoptic phenomena in San rock art, and many of these were misinterpreted, as usual, by these early 20th century Eurocentric researchers. Some of them misinterpreted them as European ships from centuries ago. And I think part of it was like that's how art got to South Africa kind of thing. Navicular entoptic phenomena might be involved in those bee and beehive images we just talked about also, since they're also made of these curves, right, but just kind of nested within each other. However, Lewis Williams thinks that they might be involved in a deeper way. Lots of the San art, including the one we talked about of seven figures emerging from a crack, shows what looks like a curve with a central area of invisibility, often matched up to a crack in the rock wall, and figures and things emerging from this central area of invisibility. In one rock art image that Lewis Williams analyzes closely, the outer curve of the navicular entoptic phenomena shape isn't full of zigzags or some other geometry, but rather a mess of antelope legs. A few antelope bodies are also emerging from this area of central invisibility, but there are many more legs than would match the antelopes, kind of all bordering the invisible center. From this, Lewis Williams suggests that this particular sand painter, in this instance, to translate their experience into scientific materialism, was moving past stage one hallucinations and into stage two, where hallucinations are interpreted based on prior experience and culture. So in this case, instead of just seeing some sort of geometries, zigzags or crisscrossing lines or something, bordering on this central area of invisibility, the sand painter, their brain interpreted it into antelope legs, because that's a common experience in their life where there'd be a sort of jumble of lines. That's the idea. Lewis Williams also says that this image could be interpreted as showing what shamans are trying often to do, going into other realms to control and guide herds of antelope to the San hunters, right? Just like with the rain animals, the San shamans herd them back by traveling into other realms. Another really cool image shows another navicular entoptic phenomena shape with zigzags on the outside and two therianthropes, half person, half animal, emerging from the zone of invisibility. Lewis Williams suggests that the navicular entoptic phenomena was interpreted by the San Rock painters similarly to the vortex hallucination that we talked about earlier. These are two lab-tested, very common hallucinations that have a central zone of invisibility. Tunnels and the much more complicated navicular entoptic phenomena. And Lewis Williams thinks that both were interpreted by the San as an entrance to other realms, to other worlds. I don't know why I'm saying realm so much. It's very hard to pronounce. Realm. Anyways. A big motif in San belief is becoming invisible or disappearing into an invisible realm. Fuck. God damn it. And when they're in this invisible world, they transform, right? So that might be an explanation for that image I just described, the therianthropes. And remember those threads of light I mentioned a while ago? Quote, then there are painted lines that represent the threads of light that San shamans say they climb when they go up to God's house in the sky. Often painted in red and fringed with tiny white dots, these threads appear to weave in and out of the rock face. It seems that the walls of rock shelters were thought of as a veil, suspended between this world and the spirit realm. Shamans pass through this veil, sometimes following the painted threads of light, and on their return brought with them revelations of what was happening in the world beyond. Unquote. I'm going to stop this episode here and continue next episode, further looking into Lewis Williams' theories. But a good place to end is Lewis Williams summing up his thoughts on San rock art by incorporating these threads of light. He says, quote, again, art, cosmos, and spiritual experience coalesced. The San fused the abstract experiences of altered states with the materiality of the world in which they lived. Perhaps most strikingly, this fusion is seen in the way in which the painted threads of light are identical in widely separated rock shelters. The uniformity of the width of the line and the spacing of the white dots is so remarkable that some researchers have felt that all the depictions of the line must have been made by a single painter, though we know that this cannot be so. It is as if there is only one thread that links all the shelters. The shamans thus constituted a network of extracorporeal travel that united distant communities, and that was manifest in the people's living spaces. Unquote. How cool is that? One thread linking all these shelters. A network of extracorporeal travel that united distant communities. I love that, and I'll see you next time.
The medicine dance of the Nguyen Mai Kong is a common occurrence. The people begin in an easy mood. More join later as the fervor of the dance increases. On an average, they dance about once a week, usually at night, and often all night long. The people take pleasure in the music and the dancing, and admire excellent performance. Although they are engaged in a serious ceremony to heal the sick and ward off evil, they are not solemn or in awe. The people act together for their well-being. It is the woman's role to clap and sing, sitting around the dance fire. A woman may dance a turn or two if the mood is upon her, always with dignified bearing. The men, singing also, dance around the women, first in one direction and then the other. Looked at one way, the purpose of the singing and dancing is to make sound. In other words, to produce music, the special medicine music of these ceremonies. The songs have no words, but they have names. Rain, sun, honey, giraffe, eland, all strong things the Kong say. During the night, they sing the songs over and over, pausing to rest briefly, starting up again with vigor. The women's clapping hands and the men's stamping feet are the accompanying percussion instruments. Some of the men beat out the basic rhythm. Others put two and three light steps onto the basic beat. The Kung believe that the songs are given by the great god and that they have medicine, ngum, a mystical potency capable of curing, dangerous if too strong. Ngum exists in the music and the dance fire. But the most important deposit is in the medicine men, who are called Mungkausi, or owners of medicine. Among the Kung, almost all men become medicine men and practice at some time in their lives. In the atmosphere of the dance, their medicine becomes hot, the Kung say. The medicine men begin to perform their curing ritual. They may already be in light trance by this time. They go to all the people again and again, laying on their fluttering hands to draw out manifest sickness and unknown ills. Their formalized gurgles, grunts, and shrieks show that this is heavy work. The Kung use no drugs to induce trance. Only medicine men go into trance, and they do so only during these curing ceremonies. Although their behavior is formalized and in general the same while they are in trance, the degree of trance varies in depth, and individual differences of emotional responses are apparent. Some men seem never to lose themselves completely. Others are deeply withdrawn. Most of them go into a formalized frenzy, gurgling and shrieking. In this state, they may get up and run about. They fall in the fire, throwing burning coals on their hair. They rush out, hurling sticks into the darkness. Thus they protect the people, for in the darkness the dead may be lurking, seeking to bring sickness or death to someone. In appreciation for this protection, women sometimes make gestures to honor the medicine men. At last, some of the medicine men fall into unconsciousness, which the Kung call half-death, believing that their spirits leave their bodies. Medicine men in lighter trance must care assiduously for those in half-death, protecting them with their medicine. The people in the film which follows have danced all night and are continuing into the dawn. The medicine men are still curing. At the end, they fall into deep trance.
I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm not going to be able to do it.